Thomas Ridd paints a picture by putting it plainly. We live in an age of disinformation. For a through line on this podcast, I will most often reference Russian disinformation, or desinformatsiya. We define disinformation in three main ways. One, this information is put out methodically. Two, content and sources may be doctored and online accounts may be inauthentic. And three, it's usually intended to weaken a target. In this case, that's us in the United States. The volume of information out there makes it extra hard to distinguish between fact and fiction. And my biggest question is, what is all this doing to us? You're listening to A Lot of Good People Told Me, and I'm your host, Alex Rose. On today's episode, I am so pleased to speak with Robert Chesney. He is a lawyer and professor in law at University of Texas School of Law, where he is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs. He is also the director of the Strauss Center for International Security and Law. So really a lot of what he studies are issues around national security law. Cybersecurity is a big part of it. He's a co-founder and contributor to Lawfare blog. He also co-hosts the National Security Law podcast. So Bobby is really an expert in this space, and a lot of his research is around deepfakes. And we get into some of the legal ramifications of disinformation and some of those implications. So without further ado, interview with Bobby Chesney. Well, hello, Bobby. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
So I know a lot of your work centers around deepfakes, quite a specific area of disinformation. Some people listening might not have heard of this concept, deepfakes. Would you mind kind of defining this phenomenon and address why it might warrant special attention?
You bet. So part of the problem here is there's some semantic slippage when people talk about deepfakes. Increasingly, people just use that as a synonym for disinformation of a video, photographic, or audio kind, which is actually pretty unfortunate because deepfakes is rooted in the idea that the capacities of neural networks to learn and generate synthetic imagery or audio has been put to work to create the fake item in question. Let me flesh that out a little bit more. The idea is that there's something different in a salient qualitative sense if and when a technology emerges that enables people to produce synthetic video audio. Well, let's just focus on video and audio and leave it at that. At a level that is well above the capacity of the human eye, the human ear, to intuitively detect that something's amiss. If that technology becomes something that can be made ubiquitous, if it becomes available to people who aren't themselves technologists and who don't have the resources of, say, industrial light and magic or what Hollywood can produce, then you've got a meaningful difference. It's the combination. The potentially potent thing is the combination of being above that threshold of verisimilitude and in a way that can be scaled and made available to a wide array of actors. So why does that lead us to the topic of deepfakes? Researchers many years ago began pitting generative algorithms. That is, most listeners will be familiar with the idea that you can feed a data set to an algorithm, train the algorithm to try to reproduce whatever the category is that you're trying to represent with the data set and to learn from it. Pitting a creation algorithm against a detection algorithm and then running them in rapid and ongoing evolutionary cycles. So they learn from one another at computer speed. It turns out, not surprisingly, to be a really powerful device for creating video and audio output that's synthesized and that's reflective of the source database, but that's not real. And that's where the idea of a true deepfake enters into the picture. So when we talk about deepfakes, at least when I'm talking about them, I'm talking about that, the product of generative adversarial networks. I'm not talking about someone who has simply modified audio or video. That's a fake. You might call them shallow fakes. You might call them cheap fakes. We've used various names for this. All of these things are a problem. And you don't even have to be at the shallow fake or cheap fake level for video and audio imagery or sound to be a problem, because you can always just change the context, change the caption, change the introduction, and tell people they're looking at something other than what they're really looking at. So there's a spectrum of manipulations that run from the extremely low tech, literally anybody could do this, to the extremely high tech. Danielle and I were trying to ring an alarm bell early on about the true deepfakes as not being more important than all the rest, but being differently important because of the diffusion potential.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're sort of concerned for two reasons. One is that there's just an increasing level of these items being convincing, but also a spread of the technology to make those that's continues to increase.
That's right. It's the intersection of those two variables that makes this something that we thought was worth ringing an alarm bell over. If it was just the one, if you had a capacity that was pretty easy to debunk and below the threshold of the human eye, the human ear, but it was widely available. Well, I mean, we've been living in that world for a long time. There's no special need to call attention to it now, although actually it seems like the need to call attention to that is it never really goes away, as we learn again and again every day. And likewise, there has, as I said earlier, been sort of the Hollywood level of being able to fake things. It's the intersection of availability with persuasiveness that is that's the very scary part.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you see as kind of a roadmap of harms? What are some of the effects of these deepfakes?
You know, the roadmap of harms in the deepfake category, it's the same conceptual categories that we can bring to bear in all the disinformation and manipulation synthetic media categories. It's just more so, right, because of the difficulty of detection. This is a problem at every place on the spectrum, from the lone individual who's not a public figure, through the public figures, through organizations of all kinds, whether they be nonprofits or for-profits, whether it be Exxon or Feed the Children, governments, international organizations, you name it, everybody has some skin in this game. So for individuals, what might that entail? The ability to engage in various forms of abuse of another individual through manipulation and portrayal of their image, their actions, their voices, it runs the gamut of human misbehavior. There is definitely a gendered aspect to this. The initial first sort of wave of attention to the use of deepfakes had to do with non-consensual sexually explicit imagery, often of famous persons. So definitely an intersection of all the nasty, horrible sorts of things that can happen in that space. You see it here, but it didn't have to be sexualized. Obviously, it could be reputational in any number of ways. You could have someone sabotage someone else's employment prospects because they're rivals for the same job. You could have them sabotage their romantic prospects because they're rival for the same prospective partner. You could have them engaged in some sort of untargeted abuse of an individual just for the laughs. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can put people in a terrible light. Scaling it up to organizations, obviously the potential to wreck an organization, at least temporarily, create lasting harm, bearing in mind that circulation of news of how this was a fake, A, who will necessarily believe it? B, that's not as interesting, won't get as many eyeballs on it as the salacious fake in the first instance. You know, the truth can't catch up with the lie, famously, especially online. So if a company's about to have a big moment and some person who's unhappy with the company decides to try to ruin that moment, this provides some fascinating and terrifying ways to try to do that. This obviously would be true whether it's a for-profit or otherwise. The chances of causing problems at the nation-state level in an international security context and otherwise, also kind of obvious. You can imagine the utility of this for an insurgency that is trying its best to portray an occupation authority of some, or governmental authority of some kind, trying to portray it in a way that's the worst possible light. You can imagine it used in a way to compromise a person who you want to have sort of discredited in the eyes of their own community by portraying them in a certain light. This could be done to lower level government officials. It can be done to the most senior peoples, including heads of state, that sort of thing. So again, regular disinformation. This is just a roadmap of all the ways that synthetic media can be used, even when it's not high-end production from a generative adversarial network. The point is the ability to take it to the next level of persuasiveness, and for a lot of people to have access to that tool, it is arriving as we speak.
I actually think that's a good way to pivot slightly and talk more about the sort of mechanisms of distribution. So the platforms I'm specifically thinking of are YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, these types of platforms where deepfakes and other disinformation is uploaded, disseminated, and often presented as fact. So we've seen some people, and obviously platforms, which I want to get into later, but they've really built their central argument around freedom of speech and sharing information, whether it's real or not. That's a thing that people are hiding behind, really, in when having this conversation. And with all of the harms that you've laid out and these issues that you think about, what do you make of that? Is that a sound argument? You know, this is my First Amendment right to free speech to post this fake thing online.
So if we look at that question through the lens of the major social media platforms, the reality is when it comes to the question of how are they doing on content, what we call content moderation, the major platforms have all come miles and miles and miles over the past decade from where they were. The real constraint was their ability to devote resources away from core mission, which is, you know, these are for-profit entities trying to create these communication platforms, and towards the cost center type activities of screening and identifying problematic content. The whole point of the platforms is they can operate at a vast scale. It's actually not fair at all to compare the content moderation challenge they face to that faced by, say, a CBS channel or some other TV channel of a traditional media variety, where the degree of control, time, and quantity of instances to be dealt with by even just the evening news is nothing compared to the moment-by-moment absolute avalanche of information and uploads flowing through any decent-sized platform. And I'm not trying to claim that either their substantive policies are optimal, nor that they've got the optimal procedures for screening and detecting and responding to these complaints. I'm just saying descriptively, it's unquestionable that they're way more focused on this and more into it than before. And yet harms still occur. There's an endless array of examples where you might say it's a false negative because look at this disinformation that's causing real world harm about vaccines, for example. And that leads to calls for some outside authority to step in through the force of law to make them do more, make them spend more, make them permit less, or change the process, change the substantive rules. And when you say in general, in the abstract, I'm interested in the government dictating what can and can't be said more, that doesn't mean it's wrong. We have lots of examples in society where that's exactly what the ultimate policy solution turns out to be. And it's in many times exactly what we need, but it means you better, if you care anything for individual liberty and for limited government, you better pay some attention to what it means to empower the government to do that. And ask yourself, is there a slippery slope here? Is this beginning to empower self-interested political figures to use the force of law to control what can be said, what can be shared? And there's just no question, if you know anything about history, that this is one of the foundational pillars for the rule of law and for the idea that the government's responsive to the people, not the other way around, that you need to be very careful in controlling and calibrating when and how the government gets to do that. So yeah, it's a tough issue. And I wouldn't say they're hiding behind the First Amendment. I would say they're central examples of one of the core purposes of the First Amendment, but that doesn't mean they're doing it right now. It just means we've got to take care in how we approach this issue.
No, and I think that's such a good way to frame it. I was talking to someone about this the other day and they were like, when was the last time you read 1984? Might be worth revisiting. But you know, it raises those notions of people committing thought crime and, you know, some of the issues that you and I got into in class in last spring, just around surveillance and the different laws that govern how much we can and cannot listen to people. And
well, let me jump in real quick just to say, like, that, you know, thought crime, in a way, the idea of it is the low hanging fruit. The whole point here is, if a government is able to dictate fully what can be said and what can be shared, then there won't be any thoughts to be crimes from that government's perspective, because people won't even be led down the path of knowing or believing certain things that may be true. This is a central task for any truly authoritarian and especially totalitarian enterprise, is to control the means through which information gets through. And then you never have to, well, you probably still will get to the business of punishing those who nonetheless end up being dissenters, but you'll have so many people who will never end up being dissidents because they've never been told what the world really entails.
Well, absolutely. And so I do think it is about a balance. You know, as I've been kind of examining some of these issues and reading the news and the different things that pop up, people either calling for these platforms like Facebook to do more to moderate this content, and conversely, people really advocating for them to do less because they're worried that this type of censorship is partisan, right? So some want the government to impose content moderation rules. Some want companies to stop moderating content. What role do you see the government playing in some of these content moderation conversations?
Yeah, this, you know, the way you put it there, I really like, because you do have this sort of odd simultaneous sort of, you know, the companies and the platforms and media in general are in a little bit of a rock and a hard place position, where you've got a tremendous amount of pressure, and this has been going on for quite a while, from governments to use the compulsion of law, compelling entities to do more to screen what can appear in their platforms. At the same time, you've begun to hear complaints, and often this is framed in sort of a partisan way, that a given platform is hostile to viewpoint or ideology X, and they're using content moderation, and especially things relating to disinformation, that's a mask for trying to silence viewpoint X on their platform. Therefore, we, the government, should come in with some sort of solution, and, you know, let's impose First Amendment standards such that the viewpoint, that it becomes somehow actionable by regulators, or maybe by private individuals bringing civil suits, God forbid, even a crime, if someone thinks they can prove in court or in a regulatory process that the platform's actually discriminating based on viewpoints. That's a super dangerous road to go down, to try to subject media, what amount to media companies, to those kinds of pressures. We're not talking about whether the government is discriminating based on viewpoints. We're talking about private businesses that are in this marketplace of ideas, and putting pressure on them in ways that are, it should be perfectly obvious, it's going to be very debatable in some instances whether that's the case, and the chilling effects. This again brings us back to the First Amendment rights of the individuals and the companies involved.
So one thing that's come up in conversations around this from a legal perspective is in the Communications Decency Act, there's Section 230. I mean, I'll let you summarize it. I can do it, but you'll do it so much more eloquently.
You know, the heart of the matter, of course, is it makes it extremely difficult to sue the publisher, the company that provides the platform, when there's something that is carried on that platform that someone otherwise views as actionable. It makes it extremely difficult by design to hold the company itself responsible for what those harms might be. And so the basic idea originally, of course, was that some companies online where they were open to user-generated content were a little reluctant to actually do the right thing when it comes to trying to police what was coming out on their own platform, especially in relation to sexually explicit materials or child exploitation materials above all. They were a little reluctant because they were worried that if they began playing that screening function, that it would shift them into a position of effectively owning what did then get through. So in order to encourage those companies to prune away the liability that was a disincentive to doing that, they were given the Section 230 immunity. And one consequence of the way it's been interpreted over time is that if you're super unhappy about their content moderation decisions, it makes it extremely difficult to take them into court. And so Section 230, it kind of reminds me of the Patriot Act as an earlier generation's statute, where there sure are a lot of people that wave the bloody flag, that swing that icon around saying 230, 230, who really have very little sense of, like, they couldn't tell you exactly what's in there. What they really mean is, I don't like it that the platforms have come to occupy such a central position in the information ecosystem. And being private companies, they nonetheless are free to make whatever decisions they want about what viewpoints they carry or allow users to transmit through their platforms or whatever it is you don't like about what they do. Now, of course, that's how it was in the days of network news and major media, traditional media, where it was sort of a few to many outlet. Yeah. And for a while there, everyone thought we had a many to many world, but they're realizing that insofar as content moderation goes on, well, it's many through a few to many, if that makes mm-hmm. sense, if you know that sort yeah. of comparison. And it makes people who don't like what they're seeing for whatever reason, whether it's people who feel like there's too much terrorism glorification. No, there's too much vaccine misinformation. No, there's too much racist speech. No, there's too much and so on around the horn, whatever bothers people. And then they spot the role of the few platforms intermediating between the many inputs and the many audience members. And they think, I ought to be able to bring to bear litigation pressure. I ought, this is America, damn it. I ought to be able to sue. Section 230 is a bulwark against what in many instances would be, no doubt some fairly righteous lawsuits perhaps, but in many instances would be vexatious and frivolous or worse. And so remove the bulwark at your peril, I guess is what I'd say. I'm not saying it shouldn't be done. In fact, there was a statutory tweak a few years ago, right before Section 230 became a household word or bad word in some cases, where in a limited sexual exploitation context, some of the protections were removed precisely in order to make the platforms feel that they had an ex-ante financial incentive to get off their butts and be more protective in screening to make sure they weren't carrying that kind of information. That was a great example of how you can take a step without falling down the whole slippery slope. That was a pretty reasonable step. And it doesn't follow that therefore all of Section 230 should go. It doesn't follow that other targeted exceptions to 230 would be survivable for this ecosystem in the same way that this proved to be survivable.
So I'm wondering, what kind of legal protections do people who've been deplatformed have? Are they sort of protected in this same area? Let's say someone has been removed from a platform because they've been disseminating disinformation or misinformation or deepfakes. Does the individual user also have those kinds of protections?
Well, let's set aside the world of social media and just go back however long we need to go back to where if you wanted to share your opinions and have them widely read, you might need to either write a letter to the editor and hope it got picked up, or much better, try to get hired on at some newspaper for the op-ed page where you get a column. And let's imagine further that somebody's got a column, and so they have a strong platform themselves through the infrastructure of this private company that's the newspaper, and they share their views. And week by week, their views start gaining a harder and harder edge on whatever the topic is, start getting more aggressive until eventually the publisher or the owner of the enterprise says, I just don't love it that our platform is being used to spread these views, which I increasingly find noxious. And I think we're going to let that person go. When a private company decides that it doesn't want to be the facilitator for that anymore, this is not some violation of your First Amendment rights. First Amendment is a constraint on the government, not on the private sector. That gets the telescope pointing exactly backwards. And we would never think, if that person was fired because of their, if it turns out they're actually fired because of their skin color or something, there are statutes that make that something you can sue for because of because there's a law that's been passed to forbid this. But the idea that you're being silenced and that should be actionable Nobody would have thought that. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, yes, descriptively, you've lost your platform, but that's too bad. That is the marketplace of ideas at work. If your ideas are good ones, keep advancing them and see if you can't find some other platform. If no one in the marketplace wants to give you a space for your ideas to be heard, that may be an indicator of the merit of your ideas. Who knows? So move ahead to the current model. It is different in many ways, but at the end of the day, the social media platforms are allowing, it's as if now everybody, every single person who wants to can all have some column inches in the newspaper, and the newspaper is going to be delivered for free to everybody. No one has to read it, but it's delivered all around the world, certainly all around the country, and everybody's in there, and you succeed or fall as you may. And now again, you're, for whatever reason, you've started saying and doing things that contravene the content moderation policies of the private business that owns that platform, and they decide, yeah, I think we're done providing you, whoever you are, with your platform. The idea that there's some, is that a bummer for you? Certainly. Is it too bad? Maybe, depends. Is it illegal? It's certainly not a First Amendment problem, unless you think that somehow, unlike the CBS and NBC Newses of the past, and unlike the New York Times and Washington Post of the past, that Facebook and the rest actually, in some sense, have transmuted themselves into quasi-public, quasi-governmental entities because, you know, as some people who advance that view like to say, they've become like places of public accommodation. And if you don't get to speak there, you don't get to speak at all in a way that everybody can hear. That was true before. It was true for traditional media. It was even more true then. You were not getting on CBS or in the New York Times to begin with if you had an edge view, most likely. Here, if one of the major platforms does not want your views, there are other places you can go. Is that do they also have a huge subscriber base? No, not necessarily. But why is this suddenly so different now? So I guess, you know, you can see kind of where I'm coming from across all these issues. I think there's a lot of motivated reasoning going on here that is ultimately, collectively, I think, creating some dangerous, unwelcome impulses that have the net effect of empowering the government, perhaps many governments at the state level, ultimately perhaps the federal government, which would then trump all the state rules, empowering the government to decide who can be heard and what needs to be said. And that is a very dangerous place to be. Look around the world. Look at how information and information platforms are controlled in authoritarian places like China, increasingly like Turkey, other places. We do not want to go there.
Right. Oh, well, thank you so much, Bobby, for being here. We could talk for hours about these issues, but just want to say thank you again and lots of food for thought.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
A Lot of Good People Told Me is produced and hosted by me, Alex Rose, a graduate Brumley Fellow at the Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas at Austin. The music you hear was composed by Alex Dupree, who also edited every episode and served as a crucial production partner. For more information, please visit alexrosebb.com or strausscenter.org. You can also follow us on Instagram at A Lot of Good People Told Me. Thanks for listening.